Good evening, everyone, and welcome to today's program, Breast Cancer Survivors and the Long-Term Effect of Breast Cancer Treatment. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during a question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star, then 1 on your touch-tone phone, and you may withdraw yourself from the question queue by pressing the pound key. Please note this call is being recorded, and I will be standing by should you need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Shira Dubitsky. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Elif. Good evening, everyone. My name is Shira Dubitsky, and I am the Director of Clinical Support at Sharsheret. I'd like to welcome all of you to tonight's national teleconference, Breast Cancer Survivors and the Long-Term Effects of Breast Cancer Treatment. Identifying as a survivor is unclear to anyone who has faced a cancer diagnosis. When do you classify yourself as a survivor? At time of diagnosis, post-treatment, 1 year post-treatment, 2 years later, 5 years later? If you are living with metastatic breast cancer, do you identify as a survivor? In the Jewish community, there is another layer of consideration that contributes to the struggle of identifying as a survivor. Historically, in Jewish history, the term survivor has been connected to those who survived the Holocaust. Embracing survivorship language in light of the Holocaust may be too emotionally laden for some women and their families. Another aspect of Jewish life and Jewish culture is the premium on family. This emphasis on family may elevate some psychosocial anxiety. Questions about growing your family and exploring fertility options may feel overwhelming and stressful. Genetics and hereditary risk vis-a-vis the health risk to the next generation is a burden that some of you may carry. In the Jewish life cycle, we celebrate milestones with our family and friends. Upon receiving a diagnosis of cancer, you may have asked yourself, will I make it to the next milestone? As I look at the number of registrants for tonight's teleconference, I know that we hit on a very critical topic that addresses the concerns of long-term effects of breast cancer treatment that so many breast cancer survivors face. Our expert speakers will address these concerns, and following the formal presentation, we will have time for questions and answers. Before I introduce our first speaker, I want to encourage all of you who have not yet received your personalized survivorship kit to get in touch with us by phone at 866-474-2774 or on our website, www.sharsheret.org, so that we can tailor your kit to meet your individual needs. The kit includes resources that address tonight's topic, in addition to other resources that many women face as breast cancer survivors. Our first speaker is Dr. Helen Coons. Dr. Coons is a board-certified clinical health psychologist who specializes in women's health and mental health and psychosocial oncology. She is the president and clinical director of Women's Mental Health Associates and a clinical professor of psychiatry at Drexel University College of Medicine. Her practice specializes in improving the well-being of women facing the diagnosis and treatment of breast, gynecological, and other cancer diagnoses. She works with women and couples of all ages before, during, and after cancer treatment. Women with early and advanced cancer, as well as individuals who are caring for ill family members with cancer. Dr. Coons brings 30 years of professional work with women with cancer, her personal journey with breast cancer, and her motivational style to engaging presentations. Dr. Coons, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much for your generous introduction and for the opportunity to participate this evening, and welcome everyone. I've been asked to spend 10 minutes talking with you about two major areas. One is the fear of recurrence or uncertainty, and the other is a broad range of psychosocial impacts related to breast cancer treatment for survivors. So first, I'd like to speak for a few minutes in very general terms about fear of recurrence, as well as coping with uncertainty for young women with metastatic breast cancer. So often, women with early breast cancer often express fears of recurrence, while young women with metastatic breast cancer face profound uncertainty. What we know from research is that some individuals report very stable levels of fear following the diagnosis of early breast cancer, while others report quite a bit of variability in their fear levels, almost like a wave. And we know that those levels of fear are affected by both individual factors and disease factors. For some young women with early breast cancer in particular, there are triggers that increase fears of recurrence, such as finishing the acute types of treatment, such as surgery and chemotherapy and radiation, follow-up visits with your oncology team, as well as follow-up tests, experiencing symptoms that you haven't had before or don't seem to go away or you don't understand, or hearing about others with disease progression or even passing away from breast cancer or other conditions. For young women with metastatic breast cancer, they often live in an overwhelming state of uncertainty. They may have had a recurrence and have metastatic disease, or were diagnosed with metastatic disease at the time of from the onset. Oftentimes, women with metastatic disease are concerned about how long a given drug will last before there's disease progression, and struggle with feelings of hopelessness or cautious optimism that the treatment could work. Whether you're a young woman with early breast cancer or a young woman with metastatic breast cancer, it's important to consider your coping options when you're struggling with fear of recurrence or sitting with profound uncertainty. First, if you're worried about a symptom or any aspect of your well-being, it's crucial that you take action instead of worrying or ruminating, which just creates more distress and actually compromises your ability to cope effectively, live well, and be present today. So it's important when you're overwhelmed with fears to mobilize support and share your feelings with your family, with your friends, or your healthcare team. It's important to talk with your providers about your concerns to get accurate information, to have appropriate assessment of your symptoms. So please call your oncology team versus staying at home worrying alone about a symptom. If you can't stop worrying about your risk for recurrence or the future, if you're overwhelmed by anxiety, your concentration becomes compromised because you're thinking about or fearful of a recurrence, or even your mood or relationships are affected, it's vital that you ask someone on your oncology team for a referral to a behavioral health provider with expertise in psychosocial oncology to help you navigate those fears and learn to be calmer and more present, even in the context of having waves of anxiety. So that was just a brief summary of some of the kinds of issues so many women young women with early breast cancer and young women with metastatic disease report around fear of recurrence and uncertainty. I'd like to spend the next 5 minutes talking about some highlights of psychosocial issues that come up as a result of treatment, both during and following treatment for breast cancer. I think that Dr. Partridge is going to be speaking about ChemoBrain this evening, so I'm going to skip that particular issue and we can come back to that as needed. Before I go through a long list of issues, I want to remind everyone that data overwhelmingly underscores how resilient women are in coping with breast cancer. But being resilient doesn't mean that coping with early and metastatic breast cancer among young women isn't difficult. In fact, it's highly difficult, stressful, and sometimes overwhelming. But you can also be highly resilient. So with that as context, for many young women before diagnosis, you have plans for work, for relationships, travel, children, or any number of issues in your life, and now face uncertainty and complex decisions, which at the very minimum is stressful and frequently overwhelming at both initial diagnosis with each treatment decision, with your experiences with treatment, and any change in your disease status or treatment protocol. One of the major psychosocial challenges for young women with either early or metastatic breast cancer is feeling off trajectory from your peer group. Now you may need support from family when you've recently moved away or started a relationship or just got married. You may need to take breaks from graduate school or delay jobs or change decisions or watch your peer group go on to make other decisions when you feel like you're overwhelmed by breast cancer treatment. In addition, many survivors are coping with both acute and long-term side effects from surgery, chemotherapy, radiation, and hormones, which can affect your trust in your body, can change your body image, and sexual health. Interestingly enough, while many young women with breast cancer are likely to report negative changes in body image and sexual health, they're not always negative changes. Some young women use breast cancer diagnosis and treatment as an opportunity to take better care of their health and are proud that they've gotten through such a physically and emotionally demanding experience. It's important to recognize that single young women with breast cancer report a strong interest in dating, but are also quite concerned about how to navigate relationships during and after breast cancer treatment. Interestingly, disclosure issues are hard enough under the best of circumstances, but now they're even more complex in the age of social media, where you may have already shared your breast cancer experience online in any number of forms. Dating issues are even more complicated for single women with advanced disease. These issues are true for young women with breast cancer who are in heterosexual and or same-sex partners, relationships. Another major area, psychosocial area for young women with either early or metastatic breast cancer involve changes in sexual desire, satisfaction, and comfort, which can be especially challenging for young women who have gone through chemotherapy or prophylactic oophorectomy. In addition, as our moderator noted, fertility concerns, parenting options, and decisions about adoption are especially complex for young women with early and advanced breast cancer. In addition, many young women may have not have started a family or want more children and remain overwhelmed by the very complex issues that result from chemotherapy and pelvic surgery. Fortunately, we have increasing number of fertility options, but certainly many young women with breast cancer are faced with uncertainty, anxiety, and sadness as they navigate some of the fertility options. Another area of psychosocial impact has to do with changes in communication and emotional intimacy with partners, family, friends, and coworkers. In addition, as our moderator mentioned, there may be very complex concerns about genetic risk for yourself, for children, and for other family members, as well as anxiety about the complex decisions around prophylactic or prevention options. For many young women, both with early and metastatic breast cancer, there's noticeable concerns about how women will care for themselves or their children if their health status becomes more compromised. And this is especially true for young single women with advanced breast cancer or young partnered women with advanced breast cancer. Interestingly enough, research helps us know that one of the psychosocial impacts of cancer treatment is also something called benefit finding. So in the midst of coping with breast cancer at any stage, as well as its treatment, data repeatedly tells us that almost 90% of women with breast cancer report some kind of positive benefit as a result of this experience. Some of you may have noticed that you actually feel that your self-esteem in some ways is improved as you see yourself navigate such a complex experience. Some of you may give yourself more of a voice in relationships at home, at work, and in your community. You may have noticed that your communication has improved or that you've decided to pursue interests that you're more passionate about versus just having a job. Some of you may have taken positive risks, such as taking a hike or learning to fly or starting to run. Many of you may have noticed that you let go of the small stuff and don't focus on some of the nonsense of life, but instead are more focused on who and what is important to you and your heart. These are just to name a few examples. While I could go on and on with the very broad and complex range of psychosocial impacts from breast cancer treatment, breast cancer diagnosis and treatment, I think I'll stop there so we have more time for Dr. Partridge's remarks and plenty of time for all of you to engage in a lively conversation. Thank you.
Dr. Kuntz, thank you very much. I think that your overview was probably very validating to many of the women who are on the call with us tonight. And I do hope that during the question and answer period that you would be able to address maybe some strategies to deal with some of these psychosocial issues. So thank you very much for that. Our next speaker is Dr. Ann Partridge. Dr. Partridge is the founder and director of the Program for Young Women with Breast Cancer and the director of the Adult Survivorship Program at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. She is an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Partridge completed her residency in internal medicine at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania and went on to complete fellowships in medical oncology and hematology, and she received a master's in public health from Harvard School of Public Health. She is a medical oncologist who focuses on the care of women with breast cancer, and she has a particular interest in the psychosocial, behavioral, and communication issues in breast cancer care and treatment. Dr. Partridge?
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here with you in spirit and virtually tonight, and thank you very much for Shasharat for sponsoring this teleconference. I just want to echo what our last wonderful speaker said regarding the psychosocial effects of a breast cancer diagnosis and treatment for any patient with breast cancer, but young women in particular, and how profound and life-changing an experience it can be. And that is, for young women, kind of the norm. It's not an exception. And so getting help for that, if you feel like you need it, I think is really kind of a normal thing, and I strongly encourage folks that are having a hard time and or think they might have a hard time to be proactive about that, because you know, you're going through, what I like to say to my patients is, you know, you're often, women are super women, they do a lot, they're extremely resilient, but they're going through an extraordinarily super abnormal time. And to get through it, I think everybody needs a little extra support and help, and some need more than others, and recognizing that and taking it, I think, is critical. So I won't keep talking about that, but I think that's probably one of the most important things about breast cancer survivorship, particularly for younger women. And I think that I'm glad that you led, because I think it's just so important and it was prioritized, so that's terrific. I'm going to focus on follow-up care from a medical standpoint, again, recognizing that much of this is framed by the psychosocial to some degree, the emotional stuff. And I've been asked specifically to focus on cognitive dysfunction and lymphedema and things of that sort. But, you know, when I speak to groups of doctors about this, I actually show them a laundry list, and I say, look, this is the potential long-term late and medical effects that can happen to patients, the physical stuff. Most people don't have everything. In fact, and most people will feel whole and kind of get to that new normal physically and medically. And as we all know, most breast cancer survivors will be long-term survivors, and even women living with metastatic disease, especially more and more these days with new therapies, are living with their disease. And that's, to me, the definition of being a survivor. You're living. And so, women in that experience who are on more chronic therapy have a different type of side effect profile to deal with over time, as well as different emotional needs. But I just want to frame this as, you know, what are the goals of following up with your care team in follow-up care? And again, let's assume that we're not talking about, obviously, when someone's getting chemotherapy and or living with metastatic disease, things are a little bit different. So I'm going to focus on kind of the conventional follow-up care, the person who's NED, no evidence of disease, but living with risk. And I'm not going to focus on the fear of recurrence stuff that we just heard so eloquently addressed, but we all know that's such a huge issue. So the goals of follow-up care are, you know, when I see a patient, main things are wondering, you know, is that person at risk of recurrence, and is any symptom that they're telling me about likely related to a recurrence or a new primary breast cancer? You may or may not realize that, but when your doctor or your nurse practitioner or whoever's caring for you sees you, they're constantly screening for that, because that's really what they're trained to do, and that's part of their job. And the other big thing they need to screen for is new primary breast cancer or other cancers they need to think about. And for young women, that's something where we also think about genetic risk. I know you know, especially in the Ashkenazi Jewish population where the risks are higher of having a BRCA1 or 2 mutation, that's something that needs to be thought about with you and your care team. And if one does have a mutation in BRCA1 or 2 or some of the more rare genetic changes that can exist, then, of course, counseling and discussion about what one might do to mitigate that risk, to reduce that risk and or screen differently is warranted. But that's kind of what medical oncologists and the care teams are trained to do, and we're pretty good at that, focusing on seeing disease coming back if it's going to, again, not the common thing, but it unfortunately does happen, as well as thinking about new disease. But increasingly, we also need to monitor, prevent, and treat long-term and late effects. And what do I mean by long-term and late effects? I alluded to them previously. So long-term effects are things that happened when you were in the middle of treatment. You know, you woke up from surgery and your underarm was numb, and if it stays that way, that's a long-term effect. And a late effect is you woke up from surgery, your arm was okay, 2 to 3 years down the line, your arm swells. That's lymphedema, generally. And that's a late effect. So not something that happened initially, but happened later on. And, of course, the long-term and late effects, and there are many, many examples. I can go through others, and people are welcome to ask more questions, and I'll focus on the ones I've been asked to focus on. But, you know, the long-term late effects can be related to the disease itself or to the treatment. And, again, it's not only, you know, medical issues, but it's the psychosocial concerns, and there are different kind of trajectories in the survivorship space where people feel emotionally good, and then they sink right after finishing therapy, and then they may feel better later on as they get further out from their diagnosis and treatment, and then feel worse on an anniversary or their first mammogram, and lots of different things can trigger somebody feeling badly emotionally in survivorship, as we heard from our speaker. The other huge thing that oncologists, beyond kind of warning people about things that are preventable, long-term late, monitoring, preventing, treating, is to be available for future medical concerns. And especially when you're talking about young women, like I'm sure you listeners are, okay, so you're young, you're healthy, in your average 30 to 40-year-old, we don't worry about bone health normally. And especially someone who continues to menstruate through treatment or beyond, that person probably isn't high risk for bone thinning right then, but they may go through premature menopause because they got chemotherapy in the past, and then their bones may be at higher risk. Fertility is obviously another future medical concern, or when a woman goes, an emotional concern, and when a woman goes through through treatment and then later on has hot flashes because she's going through menopause later, especially when she goes through treatment young and doesn't go through menopause, well, the answer in the general medical population is give her some estrogen and and then we'll taper it off. But in a breast cancer survivor, that's something that we generally want to avoid. So the medical oncology team can be very, very helpful with that. And then finally, what's the other goal with follow-up care? Well, there's a big bucket that I think psychosocial falls under, but it's really being there to encourage adherence with hormonal therapy if you've been recommended to take that. We now know that, you know, tamoxifen 5 years is good, but 10 years is maybe a little bit better for some women. It's not a no-brainer for all. Optimizing health behaviors, so we know that exercise, staying or getting slim, and taking care of yourself improves how people do in the long run, at least in observational data. If women aren't told that by their care team, they're less likely to do it. It's hard enough, but at least you have to know about it and you have to be encouraged to do it. And then we provide updates and support. So when treatments change, when we learned that 10 years was better than 5 years, when, you know, new medical changes come about, if you're not plugged in, at least to some degree, then you may not learn that. So that's our increasing role as medical oncologists, and that's what you all as patients and or loved ones of patients need to know. You know, what should you be expecting in these follow-up visits? What are the goals? And as I said, there are a number of potential complications of therapy and treatment. When I think about the potential complications and long-term late effects that women can experience, I like to group them as things that are probably mostly due to local therapy, and those things are pain, numbness in the arm, breast or chest wall area or under the arm, restricted range of motion, cosmetic changes, and then there are more rare things. And the more rare things, like people can get infections, they can have other things happen in the skin or chest wall or underlying lung, those things are more rare and we don't tend to screen for them, but of course we react. So I always tell my patients, if you've got a problem that you think has anything to do with your breast cancer or your breast cancer treatment, I want to hear about it first and then I want to do the triage. I'd rather have you let me know and let me help you rather than you worry alone and get bounced around with your primary care or somebody else, unless someone's really far out. So local therapy things, and then there are things that are due to the chemotherapy and potential biologic agents if those were received. And those are things that people, if they got chemotherapy, are well familiar with, like there's risk with some drugs of neuropathy and secondary heart problems and premature menopause and sexual dysfunction and bone thinning. And some of those things, the latter things, are due to either chemotherapy or hormonal therapy. And then, of course, hormonal therapy, the big things are menopausal symptoms and then some of the more side effects like hot flashes and vaginal discharge from tamoxifen or bone thinning from the aromatase inhibitors if someone's on ovarian suppression. So, again, I could go on and on and on, and I'm happy to take specific questions about any potential long-term late effect. But I think having a healthy awareness of side effects of drugs is important. I think communicating well with your care team what you're experiencing and asking what's normal, what's not, and most importantly, what's tolerable and what's not. So, you know, there are many things we can do to help people if they're suffering, but if we don't ask you and or you don't tell us, we can't then help. So, for example, sexual dysfunction is a classic problem, which is both medical and emotional, and there are studies that have shown that if you intervene, as in figure out what's wrong, and usually there's multiple things wrong, both emotional and medical, and then you do targeted interventions, both emotional and medical, you can improve sexual functioning. So it's not a lost cause, but that's one of those problems that often doctors either don't ask because they're afraid, they don't know how to handle it, they don't want to open the Pandora's box, they don't feel like they are schooled in it or have the resources, so they might not ask. And then patients, of course, you might be uncomfortable with that, asking or bringing it up. So I'm saying these things to empower you to say, it is our job as oncology providers to be able to care for, if we care for women with breast cancer, we should be able to help them with the side effects and the long-term late effects, and that includes sexual dysfunction, and we should know who to send them to. So ask. And there's lots of resources available for young survivors about this, and I'm sure Shoshara has some. So that's one topic I just wanted to make sure I addressed that I wasn't asked to, but it's really important. But I was asked to talk about the long-term late effects of lymphedema. So lymphedema is basically swelling of the arm on the side where surgery was performed under the axilla or in the chest wall on the side where someone had breast and or axillary surgery. And it can occur shortly after surgery, but very commonly we see it several years out. It's something that very rarely in the current day is disabling. When we used to do big wax in the axilla, big surgeries under the arm, we used to see a lot more. Fortunately, breast surgery, and particularly with the sentinel node procedure, we see a lot less of severe lymphedema. And what we tend to see more now is kind of subclinical mild lymphedema that's mild on the scale of when we measure it, but can be very burdensome for women and irritating and feel both medically and cosmetically like a big burden. And the risk of it, again, is related to the extent of the axillary surgery, so we see it less because we do less axillary surgery and less aggressive ones. And then it can also be increased if one gets radiation under the axilla, gets chemotherapy. And then another big offender in terms of risk of swelling is gaining weight. So this is another good reason not to gain weight. People tend to do better for a lot of reasons, and they tend to have less lymphedema. Prevention of lymphedema may help, and so avoiding infection or trauma, burns, Venipuncture, meaning blood draws on that side, is probably prudent. Avoiding weight gain, encouraging weight loss. And then many women choose to wear a sleeve, a compression sleeve, with a glove or a gauntlet to squeeze the hand, because if you just wear the arm squeeze, then you'll end up with a swollen hand if you have true lymphedema. And from a prevention standpoint, a lot of women will wear it on a plane because there's pressure changes. Not great data to tell us that it absolutely works, but I recommend women do it if they want to and see how they feel. You know, lymphedema is one of those things that you have to make sure that you don't make the treatment worse than the disease. I've had some patients come in and tell me they were casted for the prevention of lymphedema, and I say that feels a little crazy to me, but maybe somebody knew what they were doing. But once someone gets lymphedema, and especially if it's refractory to just swelling and just regular, you know, if refractory to sleeves, then that's something you want to be more aggressive about. And there are something called complete decongestive therapies that can be done. And usually you can get to this through physical therapy if you get this problem. But I think the most prudent thing for someone who doesn't live with lymphedema but is at risk, meaning you have had some axillary surgery, is kind of basic common sense compression. Get the sleeve, get the gauntlet if you want it, or for either treatment or prevention. Some physical therapy can often help. And then try and either stay a good body mass or try and lose weight if you can and avoid trauma to that limb. The really cool thing that we've learned in the last few years is that you, in contrast to what was thought for years, which was don't use that arm to lift weights or carry groceries or carry your pocketbook, we've actually learned that exercise is probably a good thing for the treatment or prevention of lymphedema. A, it keeps you slim, but B, in a couple studies that were done where women wore sleeves, so this is an important note, women wore sleeves and then they participated in exercise programs with people who knew what they were doing. So they were monitored, it was graduated, meaning as in gradual weightlifting with the upper extremity, while women were wearing sleeves, compared to a control group. The women who exercised, again, very gradual, low weights, wearing sleeves, they had fewer developments of lymphedema, and they had, of those who had lymphedema, they had fewer exacerbations, fewer flare-ups among the women who had lymphedema. And so what I take that to mean is that it's good to exercise, but do it gingerly. And there is a group called the American Society of Sports Medicine. I think it's ASSM, and they have a website, and they have guidelines for exercise for women after breast cancer. And maybe someone from Shasharit could send it out to all the people on the call, because there you can go to their website, and you can look both at the guidelines, but you can also find people in your area who are trained to deal with breast cancer survivors, particularly with regard to the lymphedema risk and the exercise after breast cancer. And I strongly recommend that, because I keep talking about exercise, and when people say, how do I do it? I'm not sure how to get started and what's safe, and this is a really good way to start. And you know, even if you're somewhere where you don't have someone in your area, you could bring the guidelines to somebody, a trainer, and say, you know, take a look at this, and can you help me with this if you need some help yourself, or you can read it yourself. I'm going to switch gears a little bit, but I'm going to stay on the theme. Okay, we're talking about recovery and or, you know, the teachable moment. You weren't taking care of yourself maybe before, but now you've had a diagnosis of cancer. You've said, I'm going to take advantage of this and try and change some things. And we gave you chemotherapy because you needed it for your high-risk breast cancer, or, you know, you just had enough risk to warrant it. And now you're tired. And you go into the doctor, and the doctor, someone like me, very well-intentioned, is saying, go out and exercise. It'll make you feel better. And you're saying to me, I can't get off the couch. How do you expect me to exercise? And so fatigue is extremely common. And very related to fatigue is chemo brain. So I put them together. And it's not so clear that they can be separated. In fact, there's some biologic information that suggests these days that they're related biologically, and that certain cytokines or humors in our body that are up in people with fatigue are also up in people with chemo brain, and that most people with fatigue have some chemo brain if they got chemo, and most people with chemo brain have fatigue. So they seem to be very, very related, and they're very common after a treatment with chemotherapy. Increasingly, we're suspecting that there may be some cognitive changes also with some of the hormonal therapies. Many women complain of that as well. The good news is they don't tend to be severe, and particularly for chemo brain, they tend to get better over time. What I always like to do, though, is especially when it comes to the fatigue aspect, is make sure there's nothing else going on. So just because you got breast cancer and you got chemotherapy doesn't mean you can't have other things happen to you during that time that may be related but may not. So you had surgery. If you have pain and you're not sleeping at night from that pain, that's going to make you tired, and that may make you not function quite as well, either mentally or physically. If you're not eating well and your nutrition is not good, same thing. Hypothyroidism is a common disease in all women in our society, and there's no reason why, because you got breast cancer, you're not also at risk for that. And so sometimes if people are really tired, I'll check their thyroid and just make sure I'm not missing something. I've diagnosed a number of hypothyroidism cases for women, and you treat them with thyroid medication and they're made better. Anemia, so low red cells, low blood count, that can make people tired, and it's certainly not helping getting oxygen to your brain. Insomnia, which can be due to those things, as well as hot flashes, as well as anxiety and distress and disruption and all that, can be, insomnia can really take a toll on a person's physical and cognitive functioning in the morning and beyond. So that's something that we also address, and there are many programs now for sleep. And actually, one of the biggest things that can help sleep, again, I'm going into the psychosocial, is cognitive behavioral therapy to help with sleep. It's been showing, you know, we can slap drugs on you, but that's a temporary fix. There are good psychological things that can help people to make their sleep better and more restorative, and they can often be less fatigued and have less cognitive dysfunction subsequently. Finally, depression can make people feel terrible emotionally. Obviously, it's a terrible emotional state, but make people tired and can be associated with chemo brain type features and cognitive problems, as well as inactivity. And that's why I do recommend exercise as the first line of defense for fatigue once someone is able to get off the couch if they're really exhausted. So inactivity can really contribute to, and these things are all vicious cycles, but to increasing fatigue and be associated with chemo brain. So once you've ruled it out and or, you can't treat the inactivity until you help someone with the fatigue, what do we recommend people do? Well, there are lots of things, and I alluded to some of them. So one is, for chemo brain and fatigue, exercise, behavioral and psychotherapy. Complementary therapies can work for some women, and we definitely recommend trying them. When I say complementary therapies, here I mean things like relaxation, Reiki, mindfulness, massage, ingesting things I'm not as much of a huge fan of. The data don't suggest that any particular thing works, to be honest with you, but I think as long as it's not harmful, it's okay to try. For fatigue, we just studied psychostimulants like Ritalin, and it actually doesn't seem to work very well, so I don't recommend that as a rule, but sometimes we'll try it because we want to try everything and someone's profoundly tired, and sometimes it can work. And then for chemo brain in particular, there's increasing evidence that when people feel that they're having cognitive problems, that paying attention to it and actually exercising your brain can help. So doing crossword puzzles, doing things that force you to memorize a poem or do something that because it's hard to find words or it's hard to do those kinds of tasks. Practicing using your brain. I know that sounds a little silly, but exercising that brain muscle, just like you would try and get your body back in shape physically, has been associated with improvements of chemo brain. And then finally, reassurance and trying to mitigate any anxiety a person might feel if they have chemo brain. Because, of course, if you add anxiety on the, what does this mean that I can't remember this word? I can't remember words all the time, but because I didn't get chemo, I don't stress about it that much. And I think adding anxiety onto it makes things worse, and you're bound to forget more words or have more trouble. And the other thing is to accommodate oneself. So I tell my patients, okay, you were a high-functioning multitasker. You're still high-functioning, but maybe it's time not to multitask for a little while. Take care of yourself. Take one thing at a time. Smell the roses a little bit more. make lists, check them off. Don't be afraid to look back at that list and give yourself a little bit extra time to get through stuff if you're having a hard time, would be what I recommend. And I'd be interested to hear if our other speaker had any other suggestions for that, in particular in the Q&A. And then finally, the other area I was asked to talk about was bone health. I've alluded to it. You know, this is something we increasingly think about with our survivors and basically all women with breast cancer, because in postmenopausal women, their bones are thinning anyway generally, and we give them aromatase inhibitors. In premenopausal women, we give chemotherapy, which reduces bone mass by virtue of often shocking the ovaries, if not lowering, you know, making them permanently dysfunctional. And then we also give treatments that suppress the ovaries, which again thin the bones. Tamoxifen actually in young women, if you still have menstrual functioning, can actually thin bones as well. And so we think about bone health in all young women, and if a person is not having regular menses and or at high risk for osteoporosis or osteopenia, meaning your mother had it, you're very thin, you don't do weight-bearing exercise, it's reasonable to get a baseline bone mineral density. Women who are on ovarian suppression or on ovarian suppression and aromatase inhibitor should absolutely be followed with a bone mineral density. And then if you have low bone mineral density, then treatment is very reasonable. And it's, we don't know when to start, and it's a very personal decision. But, you know, we can use the bisphosphonates like zoledronic acid or drugs like denosumab that can be used to help strengthen the bone. More importantly, though, prevention can help. So weight-bearing exercise, having a diet that's high in calcium. We don't recommend calcium supplementation anymore for prevention very much, because there's some concern that calcium supplementation may hurt people's hearts in the long run. Vitamin D, we want to make sure that our vitamin D levels are okay. We're not sure that it helps from a breast cancer treatment standpoint, but it helps for the bones. These are all things women can do to help their bone strength, and avoidance of cigarette smoking and minimization of alcohol are two other big things that are both good for your bones and obviously good for your overall health in general. So, you know, I'll stop there, and my final comment is all of this stuff I've talked about is just a snapshot of things that women can kind of do to help themselves, and a snapshot of problems people can encounter that can be helped as you kind of live beyond your breast cancer diagnosis. And so it's really important that you feel empowered to bring your concerns to your doctor, make lists whether you have chemo brain or not, not just about your questions, but about kind of what's worrying you and, you know, what should you expect next. And I actually think it's important that we all start, and there are some mandates to do this, start giving people, all patients with cancer and women with breast cancer specifically, recommendations at the end of care, the early active care, to say, here's what you got, here's what you went through, and here's what you need to do moving forward. We call that a treatment summary and survivorship care plan, and there are other names for that. And I'm telling you all about that if you haven't heard of that already, because it's kind of a roadmap for your future. We can't tell the future, but we can at least say what we think you should do to optimize your future health. And it's also a roadmap for your other care providers, because your medical oncologist isn't going to do all of this. Your primary care can do your bone stuff. There are other people who can help. They don't need to do it all, but you kind of need to know what to expect. So I would start demanding from your oncologist, don't tell them I sent you, things like a treatment summary and survivorship care plan. And if you can't get one from your oncologist, there are different resources where you can get things like that and on the web. So I'll stop there, but I'm happy to answer any questions about any of that.
Dr. Parcher, thank you so much. And I want to share with you that we actually have a care plan in our Thriving Again Survivorship Kit. And as Dr. Partridge mentioned, I encourage you to bring that care plan to your treatment team and have them fill out the medical portion of the care plan. And as Dr. Kuntz had mentioned, that in this care plan, we also have questions and areas to fill out that address the psychosocial aspects as well, and I would encourage you to fill that part out as well. Dr. Parches, thank you. I think one of the big takeaways is the importance of knowing your body, trusting your gut feelings, and most importantly, recognizing that you are very much a part of your treatment team, and you need to make sure that you have open lines of communication with your doctors so that these symptoms and concerns can be addressed.
I couldn't agree more, and I think, again, that speaks to the psychosocial, too. People need to feel comfortable with their care. They need to feel safe from both an emotional and a medical standpoint that they're getting what they need.
Thank you. We now have time for questions and answers. You can ask your question by pressing star 1. We ask that you keep your questions broad in nature so that all of those joining us tonight can benefit from the discussion. So we've already had questions coming in. Dr. Coons, what has your research found that perhaps offers two or three strategies to address some of the psychosocial concerns that you identified?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question? The phone delayed on getting off of mute.
Okay. What has your research found that offers two or three strategies to address the psychosocial concerns that you identified?
Well, actually, not my research, but several of our colleagues nationally have outstanding research with large groups of women with early breast cancer that point to several areas. First, taking a very active look at mobilizing support. This is very important. It's a long-term finding in research on health and health outcomes and health quality of life that we invite young women with breast cancer to be very specific on seeking contact and deepening your connections and creating community. I call that the three C's. For example, we have a repeated data that helps understand that emotional support improves practical problem solving, emotional support, feeling less alone and isolated. Going through breast cancer treatment, whether you have early or advanced disease as a young woman, is not something we want you to do alone. Many of you have heard the expression, it takes a community or a village to raise a child. Well, it takes a community or a village to support women going through breast cancer as well. So one crucial evidence-based strategy is to certainly mobilize support from individuals in your life who can be there for you. And that sometimes different individuals will be there in different ways, whether practically, emotionally, or spiritually, or financially, for example. Another major area is the overwhelming data that Dr. Partridge alluded to that has to do with the benefits of exercise for women, especially with hormone-positive breast cancer, but really any women with breast cancer, almost at any stage, unless you have very, very, very advanced disease. 3 to 5 times a week. The data underscore the benefit of aerobic exercise on reducing anxiety, improving concentration and focus, improving sexual energy and body image, improving all the biomedical outcomes like bone health and heart and those kinds of things, but also our sleep. And that's probably the third area that I want to mention specifically, that we know that stabilizing sleep is essential to our well-being. Sleep is one of the biggest drivers of our energy, of our emotional well-being, including mood and anxiety. Sleep affects our weight and metabolism, and it affects our cognitive skills, among many, many other indices. So it's very important that if somebody's not sleeping, doesn't have good sleep quantity or quality, that they talk to their oncology team. And they may very much benefit from excellent cognitive behavioral techniques, as Dr. Partridge alluded to, that can be highly effective in shifting and restabilizing your sleep cycle. It's very hard to navigate these complex decisions when you're not well rested. And disease and treatment in and of itself compromises your energy. So it's crucial for all the reasons we've noted that you're sleeping well. Finally, I'll mention some of the research on some of the benefits of compartmentalizing your experience with your breast cancer and its treatment. For example, taking the best care of yourself, whether it's to see your doctors or to adhere to medications, or if you're not, to talk to your oncology team maintain good weight and get exercise and limit your alcohol and certainly not smoking, and taking good care of your relationships. At the same time, finding time to kind of not be just a cancer patient, that all of the women on this call are daughters or sisters or mothers or professionals or workers or athletes or artists or musicians or whatever the example, to understand and recognize that while we might have cancer, cancer doesn't have to have us. And the compartmentalization of the experience is a very helpful coping strategy. And it also gives individuals with cancer the kind of time out and more resilience then to cope with the kinds of challenges that are so common for both women with early and advanced disease.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Kunz. Dr. Partridge, we have a couple of questions about lymphedema specifically. So I'll pair these two together. How many years after surgery does a survivor need to wear a lymphedema sleeve on airplane flights? And the second question that came in, is there such a thing as a lymphedema specialist?
So the first answer is lymphedema occurs because you've had surgery under the arm that has disrupted the lymphatic channels, the roadways, as an analogy, that allow fluid that's normal in all tissues of your body to drain out of that limb. And when that channel is disrupted, it's pretty much disrupted forever. And so you're at risk forever. And so when you say, how long does one need to wear the sleeve, you don't, quote-unquote, need to wear the sleeve, but if you choose to wear the sleeve for prevention, then you're going to be probably wearing it forever. On the flip side, if you choose to try it for the first couple years or as long as you want to, and then you say, you know what, I'm kind of done with this, I'm going to take a watch-and-wait approach, that's okay too. And it's okay at some point to say, you know, I haven't gotten lymphedema yet, I'm tired of wearing the sleeve, we're not even sure that the sleeve prevents. The data don't necessarily support that. And so, you know, I think it's okay to wear it, but I think it's also okay to say, I'm going to hold off and I'll use it if I need it and do more of a kind of treatment and symptom management as opposed to a prevention use of a sleeve, especially when someone's pretty far out. But I don't know when. There's no cut point. The second question, which was the lymphedema specialist, there are people out there who call themselves lymphedema specialists because they've decided to devote extra effort and expertise to learning how to deliver good lymphedema focusing physical therapy. And so, yes, there are lymphedema specialists out there. There is actually a lymphedema, I think it's a society that you can find online, and they probably could direct you to people who focus on this. Your healthcare providers could also likely direct you to local physical therapy folks that focus on lymphedema. If they take care of a lot of breast cancer patients, they'll know who the go-to folks are.
Thank you. We received actually several questions about the impact of treatment on the heart. Can you briefly address that, Dr. Partridge?
Sure, very briefly. Certain treatments like anthracyclines, Adriamycin, Epirubicin, as well as trastuzumab or Herceptin, in particular can affect the heart. The other thing that can affect the heart, although increasingly less, is radiation. All these things can affect the heart, and so especially if you had left-sided radiation, but with newer techniques we think it's less. We try very, very hard to avoid the doses of Adriamycin or Epirubicin that would affect the heart. We don't go above certain amounts so that the lifetime total that a person gets, they're not at high risk of having heart damage, at least overt heart damage right after the chemotherapy. But, of course, some people still may, and that is a concern. Obviously, whenever we give any of those therapies, we weigh that in when we say, you know, do the risks of the chemotherapy, are they justified when you consider the risk of the cancer. Trastuzumab or Herceptin, it's one of those things that it's increasingly less cardiotoxicity are we seeing because we don't pair it with certain drugs and we're more aware of it and we can monitor it. And the nice thing about the trastuzumab-related cardiotoxicity, that's for women with HER2-positive breast cancer, that it seems to be very reversible. But for some women, it can be devastating. And the cardiac complications of cancer care, while rare, are extraordinarily serious. And it's something that we take very, very seriously in the sense that we don't give the chemotherapy and we think, unless we think the risks are far outweighed by the benefits. And then, of course, we have a very, very low threshold for looking into symptoms that might be related to cardiac problems like shortness of breath, chest pain, and the like.
Thank you. Dr. Kunz, is it helpful for survivors if they become more active in breast cancer, in the breast cancer community, or can continuing to remain engaged in the cancer community trigger fears and anxieties?
That's a very interesting question. I don't know of data that speak to definitively one way or the other. I can tell you from decades of clinical experience that there are some individuals who find being actively engaged in advocacy and around breast cancer research and care, healthcare policies, actively involved in supporting the well-being of other women going through similar experiences, is grounding, is empowering, is profoundly meaningful. There are other individuals for whom that is either overwhelming or they want to limit their focus of their energy on breast cancer to getting themselves well and then need to focus on other parts of their life and may contribute quietly to an organization or may quietly support another woman in her community or family, but are less inclined to be extensively involved with an organization around advocacy, education, or support. Dr. Partridge may know of some data. I have not seen anything that I would consider excellent data. And you had a second part of that question.
The second part is about whether or not it can be more of a trigger for anxiety.
Well, I think we are all aware that many young women with early and advanced disease find October triggers a host of feelings, ranging from connectedness and empowerment to feeling absolutely overwhelmed by the amount of media that in many ways has been very helpful for breast cancer survivorship issues, advances in treatment, and for other individuals is just simply too much. It's certainly that time of the year when there's a particular focus can be difficult. But quite frankly, we have done an amazing job in some communities, certainly not all, and especially rural communities or underserved communities where there's less information, that there could be triggers any time of the year. And so part of it's just individuals understanding what their triggers are and, again, seeking support from their healthcare team, from individuals in their life, whether it's other women with breast cancer or individuals in their family and friends.
Thank you. Dr. Partridge, we received several questions about your recommendation of not taking calcium supplements. Can you expand on that briefly and maybe suggest some other options?
Yeah, so I brought that up purposely, and I knew it would be provocative. There was a recent U.S. Preventative Services Task Force report that looked at the use of calcium supplementation for the prevention of fractures and osteoporosis, and basically they reviewed all the evidence and decided that for prevention, it was not a good idea because it is associated with concern about increasing the risk of heart attacks, and it's not clearly preventative. We do recommend it for people for treatment who have definitive bone loss as a rule. But in terms of what women should do who are at risk, I asked my own primary care physician this. I've kind of grilled our osteoporosis doctors, and right now the common recommendation is try and get your calcium from food. So there's a little bit of a waffle and wiggle they're doing right now. And vitamin D supplementation appears to be okay, and that's good for the bones.
Okay. We have a question here, Dr. Koons. How do I distinguish between what is normal post-cancer anxiety as compared to anxiety that suggests I need to seek the help of a healthcare professional? And what are some of the signs I should look for?
That's an excellent question. So there's a degree of anxiety that almost all women coping with early and metastatic breast cancer would get, that we wouldn't consider that a normal reaction to a very complicated and scary experience. Then there's the fine line of when the level of anxiety that an individual might experience is affecting her functioning. For example, unable to sleep or feeling losing appetite or eating down feelings of anxiety or drinking down feelings of anxiety, finding that someone's very irritable or withdrawing from relationships. Feeling like intrusive thoughts about cancer, what the future might hold, fears and concerns are interfering with concentration and focus, whether at home or at work. So when one's quality of well-being, either emotionally or cognitively or relationally, is affected, or even physically, finding that your stomach always hurts or you have a chronic headache once you've been diagnosed, but that's more stress-related, those are indications that you really want to reach out and you want to ask your oncology treatment team for a referral to a behavioral health provider with specific expertise and credentialing and experience in providing care to women with psychosocial issues during cancer, during and following cancer treatment. So this is a time when you want to get a referral to a reputable mental health provider who has expertise specifically to help you navigate your experience with breast cancer.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Koons. We have one final question, and that is for Dr. Partridge, any research in the pipeline regarding survivorship that you think is particularly promising that we should keep an eye on? And part two, what are the best ways for survivors to keep on top of emerging research without feeling more anxious than empowered?
So I'll answer the first question by saying there's a lot going on, not as much as I would like, but a lot, and there's lots of things looking at the health behavior things, like how much does exercise add prospectively, looking at whether aspirin might help. These are all questions that we want to find out about. And there's a lot of data that suggests that aspirin, at least observationally, meaning when we look at large groups of women over time and look back and say, oh, they took aspirin, that seemed to help in terms of breast cancer risks and recurrence. But we need to look at it prospectively. These are things that we want to hear about in the future, but we don't have the data yet. I think in terms of other survivorship concerns, the other place where there's a growing number of studies is managing side effects. So neuropathy treatment is evolving, and there's lots of things that are looking into how to treat neuropathy. And there's a new drug called duloxetine that's been shown to be effective against neuropathy. So how to stay engaged with those kinds of things? I think doing what you're doing, being a part of things like Shasharit's, the teleconferences, and I'm sure I know Shasharit and other advocacy groups have blast emails. I look at those emails. And if there's anything really critical to the average breast cancer survivor, an advocacy group like Shasharit, it's going to pick it up. So I recommend staying engaged like that, and I'm sure that the messages are positive. And I think, you can be anxious if you think that every single thing applies to you. And I think if you feel that way, that may be a time to go out and seek some help, as we just heard. I just want to add, from the emotional standpoint, I think it's normal to be anxious to some degree. You were just diagnosed and had the carpet ripped out from under your feet. And even if you're someone who was living with knowing you had a breast cancer mutation, BRCA1 and 2, you still, it's still an anxiety-provoking thing to to get breast cancer and have to deal with it, and worrying about what the treatments might do. So that's all normal, but it's how you manage it, and it's not a failure at all to actually need some extra help. I actually think it's quite normal, even if you're not completely dysfunctional, to get some extra help, whether it's informational, supportive. You know, you absolutely need to get help if you have the signs and symptoms that you just heard about. But I think it's also a pretty good thing to get some extra help, either, you know, educational and some cognitive therapy to kind of wrap your head around this.
May I respond to that? This is Dr. Kuhn.
Of course.
Yeah, that's an extremely important point, that mental health providers, whether they're psychologists, social workers, psychiatrists, who are trained in psychosocial oncology, we don't want to just see individuals when they're highly symptomatic. The data does tell us that women are really very impressively resilient coping with both early and advanced disease. There's only a subset, probably around 25%, who actually need treatment for or actually meet the level of what we call kind of a diagnostic level of depression or anxiety. That doesn't mean that there aren't times when you feel sad or down. There are so many indications, however, for coming in to someone with expertise in psychosocial oncology to help improve your body image, to navigate complex decision making, to work on sexual health. Actually, one of the areas I'm always happy when oncologists refer patients early so we can help patients prepare for invasive medical procedures. We have decades of data about the benefit of coping strategies to improve outcomes with procedures. Actively prevent sexual sequelae, to improve communication, to talk about different ways to have difficult conversations with partners, with future, with current or future partners, with children, with other family members where sometimes communication can be complicated for any number of reasons. For difficult conversations about treatment selection, for concerns about preventive strategies, for self-esteem, for transitions and kind of learning about a philosophy of well-being as you navigate any part of this treatment experience. So I couldn't agree more with Dr. Partridge that you don't have to meet a kind of a clinical level of anxiety and depression to benefit greatly. And instead of viewing that kind of reaching out as selfish, it's actually quite self-respectful.
Thank you to all of you and to our speakers for that enriching question and answer discussion. You should have received an evaluation in our email, in your email, so please take a moment to complete the survey. All of our programs and support are driven by the feedback we've received from you. We are committed to staying relevant by enhancing our programs to reflect the growing and changing needs of the women and families of our Sharsheric community. Sharsheric's expertise is in young women and Jewish families, but our 12 national programs are open to all men and women regardless of background. I'd like to thank, again, our speakers for sharing their expertise with us tonight and to recognize that our program was made possible with the support by the Cooperative Agreement DP11-111 from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And we'd like to express our gratitude to them for recognizing and supporting the needs of breast cancer survivors. Finally, I would like to thank all of you for participating in tonight's program. Feel free to continue the discussion by reaching out to us by phone, again, 866-474-2774, or on our website, www.sharsheric.org. And if you would like a peer supporter to speak to about your individual survivorship questions and concerns, please call the Sharsheric office and we will be happy to connect you. Have a good night, and we look forward to hearing from you.